Hyvää huomenta kaikille ja tervetuloa tähän opettaminen kriisitilanteissa työpajaan. Meillä on ilo täällä tänään saada kuulla Ilona Taimelaa, jolla on vuosikymmenen kokemus monikulttuurisen kasvatuksen, antirasistisen kasvatuksen. Ilona on myös aktivisti koulutuksen alalla, tehnyt pitkään työtä Helsingin kaupungilla. Ilona on itsellä vahva kansainvälinen tausta, ja sen vuoksi Ilona on ollut myös luonnollinen opettaja opettamaan näitä Al-Holin lapsia, josta Ilona puhuu meille tänään. The workshop will be bilingual, so now I'm changing to English and welcoming everybody online and in Ruusupuisto to this event on the teaching or education in emergencies. We have our pleasure to welcome Ilona Taimela, who has been really a pioneer in multicultural education in Finland. Ilona has an international background herself, and she's also activist with decades of work experience in education, mainly for the city of Helsinki, but also internationally. And that therefore, Ilona was very natural choice for teaching these children in the Al-Hol refugee camp, and she will introduce herself more in details also. So people in Ruusupuisto, please have yourself a cup of coffee and pulla, and hopefully people online will be able to do the same and have some refreshments. The workshop will consist of a small lecture, and then it will be an interactive, so we will be able to share and discuss the topic. Semmoinen, mikä on tärkeä, kun me tätä työpajaa suunniteltiin, niin me ei tiedetty, että tästä tulee näin valitettavan ajankohtainen aihe. Ja joka tapauksessa, niin kuin me tiedetään Ruusupuistossa, kun ollaan kasvatustieteiden ja psykologian tiedekunnassa, että opetuksen aina pitäisi noudattaa tämmöistä turvallisen tilan periaatetta. Mutta nyt tällä hetkellä se on erityisen tärkeää, koska niin kuin me tiedetään, niin ihmiset sijoittuu oman henkilökohtaisen identiteetinsä, oman kansalaisuuden, rodun, etnisyyden taustalla eri lailla näihin keskusteluihin. Ihmiset suhtautuu eri lailla eri ihmisiin näissä tilanteissa, joissa ja tämmöisissä konfliktitilanteissa, joissa me eletään tällä hetkellä tässä sotatilanteessa täällä maailmalla. Noudatetaan turvallisen tilan periaatetta, ja se tarkoittaa sitä, että jokaisen sana on yhtä arvokas. Me ei teilata kenenkään mielipiteitä, vaan me keskitytään siihen, että kuunnellaan ja yritetään luoda semmoista empaattista tunnelmaa, kuitenkaan tietenkään ottamatta niin kuin kantaan ja niin kuin pitämättä huolta siitä, että ihmisoikeudet toteutuu tässä maailmassa. So, especially because we are in the Faculty of Education and Psychology, we all know that when we, in any kind of education setting, we should create this and follow the principles of safe space. When we started to organize this workshop, we unfortunately didn't know how relevant it would be today. And as we know, there's a lot of discussion going on in terms of the war. And we also know that people are positioned differently in the discourses that applies to the war and the conflicts going on in the world. So be mindful that everybody's opinion is important. We have to follow the human rights and we have to respect the human rights, but everybody's voice is important. The human of each, I mean, the value of each human and the human rights for everyone, regardless of where they come from, what they represent is equal. And that's the principle of the safe space, and that's the principle that we follow today. Also, just in case you feel somehow that the workshop will raise some type of emotions, there are many ways to get help in the university. Specifically for the students, there's also a drop-in guidance available. But there's also the healthcare, and there's also the study psychologist. But this is a one way of to have an easy access to get a guidance and to get referrals to further. And for the staff, please refer to the occupational health. And for the students, there's also this new ry, who is, I mean, online. And I, if you want more, or the, that I share the links, it's possible. I will do it in the chat, and you can contact me. But just in case that there's something that will remain after the workshop in your heart, know that you are not alone, and you can also seek for help. And now I pass the floor to Ilona Taimela. Welcome, warm welcome to Jyväskylä. And lastly, my name is Heidi Lane, and I'm the university lecturer in sustainable and global education in the University of Jyväskylä. Unfortunately, I cannot be there physically with you today because I have corona, so I have to coordinate the workshop from home. But my warmest welcome to Ilona Taimela and to everybody in the audience. And the event is organized jointly by the faculty and with the CHINTL project Education for Emergencies. Warm welcome to everybody.
Thank you, Heidi, over there, and welcome everybody also on my behalf over here. So like Heidi said, that my name is Ilona Taimela, and I have actually, I was starting to count that what is the first time that I was here lecturing at University of Jyväskylä, and I think it was like 28 years ago when I had my first lectures here on multicultural issues in the early 90s already. And so this has been a topic that, that I have been working on, like Heidi said, for many years. But today I have been, I'm going to share the Al-Hol case, and I have the presentation now in English, but then of course I can also answer anything in Finnish if there's any questions that come from the audience in Finnish. So let's start the, and it's a hybrid now that we have people both online and over here. Okay, so we're going to be talking today about this mobile distance education. Of course, mobile phones we have had already for quite some time, but maybe this was kind of a unique case where we were using mobile phones and WhatsApp for education, and especially in emergency. And a little bit about the background in a way that hardship locations, there's a lot of different kind of hardship locations. So fragile states and areas where usually there is, first of all, kind of there can be a war zone, like also in Syria, and nowadays, today, unfortunately, in Ukraine also, and maybe also other hardship locations like Afghanistan. But usually in fragile states and areas, there's also kind of economic crisis. And there might be child labor, armed conflict areas, and also humanitarian challenges. These kind of areas are very vulnerable in a way that there can also be extremism, and therefore also lack of educational opportunities. Also, of course, like I have written here, that like natural disasters can also affect fragile states. For example, Haiti would be this kind of a place. This particular case that actually started already in 2011 when the Syrian war started. And a lot of people also from abroad, from Western countries and also from Finland, went to the war to battle, or that there were women who went there with their spouses. Some of them, they took their children with them, or also some of them, they had children over there. So we had Finnish men and women and also children to go to who went to Syria from 2013 onwards. And the war lasted until 2019, when kind of all of the ISIS fighters were captured, who were still alive, and they were put into all different kind of prison camps. Now, Al-Hol prison camp is especially for the women and the children. There was about 60,000 people. So it's like its own city, its own ecosystem, actually. And mainly these prisoners are from Syria and from Iraq. In the Al-Hol camp, there's an annex, which is called International Annex. And the annex is then for these international people who came from all different European Union countries, but also from other countries kind of close by Syria and Iraq, for example, from from Kazakhstan or from Georgia and these kind of places as well. And even from Canada and USA, there have been fighters. So Finnish people then who left, there was about 80 people of them, of whom 30 were children. And government of Finland then decided to repatriate these Finnish, first of all, children, but then also women. It was all the time talked about that the children, in a way, have the right to return to Finland. And then the local Kurdish government said that they don't want to separate the children from their mothers, and therefore also they came back to Finland with their mothers. Just yesterday, the diplomat Jussi Tanner, who was assigned by the government of Finland to organize the repatriation, said that there's still about 10 people who are still there, and it's kind of difficult, these last ones, to get to Finland. But last children who came back to Finland, where they came back, it was on the beginning of December. So it's been a really long process to repatriate the women and the children from there. The first children and women were, or actually the children, the orphan children were repatriated in already in 2020. But then what happened is that Jussi Tanner, a diplomat, came up with the idea that could we do this kind of a distance education to the children in Al-Hol. And this was because that was when the pandemic started, and his own children were at home. And he was looking at his own children, and he thought, like, could we do something like this also with the children in Al-Hol? Because in Finland, all the schools were put to distance education in spring 2020. Okay, so he contacted then first of all the education agency, the National Agency of Education, and then they said better to contact the Lifelong Learning Foundation of Finland. Lifelong Learning Foundation has been doing distance education for 100 years in Finland, first with the letters, and nowadays it has its own kind of a nomad school for Finnish children abroad. And the Lifelong Learning Foundation then contacted me. Why me? Is because that I have been working with them for very long time, and they have also published some of my books on, for example, on multicultural childhood. And so the project began then in April, 2 years ago, in 2020, and lasted until last September 2021, during which the children and women were also repatriated to Finland. So a little bit about myself is that, yes, I have a master's degree in educational science, some also postdoctoral studies, and I have a multicultural background myself, that I have lived in 3 different continents and 6 different countries, both as a child and as an adult. And I have been teaching for over 30 years, but I have also been teaching teachers to teach, especially on multicultural issues. And my last kind of a bigger post was that when I was the educational consultant for the whole city of Helsinki, where I was coordinating all kind of participatory issues in 300 daycares, 100 schools, in vocational school, and so forth. But then I became private education consultant just before the pandemic, and then this project came to me and they asked me to join. And of course, I was a free agent in a way, and I was able to join them as well. And at the same time, I'm also a researcher at the University of Helsinki on concrete utopias as well. So the Finnish women and children then in Al-Hol, there was about 10 mothers and a little bit less than 30 children. And very young, most of them are very young. And actually even most of them have been born in Syria. So when we are talking about repatriation of the children, they were not repatriating because they were actually coming to a new country, to Finland, because they didn't know anything about Finland before coming over here. But their mothers were from Finland. Not necessarily the fathers. The fathers would have been from different citizenship. There was a really need for education. The children didn't have really anything to do. There was no routines. And this was one of the reasons why diplomat Jussi Tanner said that at least can we provide them some routines? That was kind of his idea of school, that there's a routine that they do every day, that they have some meaningful thing to do. He didn't know to the extent that what we are going to do as teachers, but he just thought, like, let's have them something at least to do. Some of the children who were, of course, older age had been in school in Finland. For example, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade at that age when they had then moved to Syria. But then they had maybe Quran school. Then at the Al-Hol camp itself, there was no schooling. But during the war, there could have been some Quran education. We didn't have any knowledge, of course, of their level when we started, but we knew that their Finnish skills are very, very poor. Some of the mothers did not speak Finnish to them, even though that they were from Finland. And that is because some of the mothers also are from multicultural backgrounds who had migrated to Finland themselves, maybe as children or as adults, and then had gone to Syria as ISIS wives or even fighters, maybe themselves. So why would they speak Finnish to their children if they didn't speak Finnish as their mother tongue, and then they married another person, let's say from Belgium or from UK and so forth, and then they had children over there. So it's like absurd, you know, in a way to think of that they would be speaking Finnish to their children. And most of them were speaking Arabic to each other, but also some mothers were speaking English to their children. But all of the mothers understood and knew Finnish because they had been in Finland and had Finnish citizenship. So citizenship is again different from, like, we have to remember this kind of a multicultural understanding of identity. So why we started doing this is also basically that in Finland, we have a very strong sense of the Universal Convention of the Rights of the Child, that we really believe that every child has the right to education. And this is very strong in Finland. It's kind of a basis of all of our curriculum. It's all written in our curriculum as well. So this is something that we really wanted to do. And of course, we have the sense in Finland also that the basic education has to be free, for example, as well. The second thing is, of course, that the United Nations Agenda 2030 for the Sustainable Development Goals also says that we all of the countries, 190 plus countries who have signed the agenda, are trying to say, you know, trying to ensure that there's an inclusive and equitable quality education all around the world for all children. And this is something that we started from. So there was no discussions with the Kurdish administration in Al-Hol. We did this in secrecy. Nobody knew that we were doing this. So there was not like asking permission from the local authorities that can we teach the Finnish children in Al-Hol, because Finland really thought like this is our duty and responsibility to do, and we have a very strong sense for this. So there was no discussions, are we allowed to do such a thing? So learning is universal and non-negotiable. So there was no negotiations therefore done for this. The pedagogical principles then that we set up was, of course, this equality and equity, what we talked about already. But it was also voluntary because they are in prison camp and we are back here. We can't force anybody to say that now you have to go to school, that, you know, get up and go to school or whatever. It was voluntary. So the first message that we sent to the women was via the diplomat, because he already had their phone numbers, and was already in contact with them via WhatsApp. And so we wrote basic kind of a message that we're going to start up a school, and it's going to be every day. It starts at 9 o'clock every day, and we're going to be teaching you Finnish language and mathematics, and then science and some other subjects are you interested. And the same day already about 7 children were signed up by their mothers, and then later more followed. And we had about 20 children then voluntarily all the time, every day, joining our teaching. So it was voluntary. It was also, we also kind of made everything, all the tasks, very individual, because all of the children had very different background and also level. So it had to be also very motivating for them, so that it was so on their own level. And that's why we needed to learn about more about them as well. So it was very interactive as well at the same time. The flexibility was an important issue, because they are in a prison camp where they are not allowed to have any mobile phones. And anyway, the mobile phone was the communication vehicle and the channel. So we had to be very flexible with that, so that if they, for example, sent us messages that the soldiers are now here in our camp, we need to hide the mobile phones. So we would say that, okay, no worries, just put them away and come back whenever you are able to do so. If it takes 1 or 2 days or 1 week, it doesn't matter. So we always had to be very flexible with our routines, even though that we had routines. Also, other kind of matter was, for example, there would be a sandstorm and their tents would be blown away. And so they would have to recuperate and put up the tents again for a few days. So there had to be all kinds of flexibility all the time. Positivity is something that we also, I think it's in a core in Finland also, that we want to have the joy of learning, to keep the motivation. So this is something that we also try to channel through our messages and through our tasks as well. Interactivity, I really did a little bit talked about that as well already, but interactivity was important also for the development of the project. It was kind of an iterative project at the same time, so that we were developing it, asking for feedback from them all the time, and then rearranging our tasks, even though that we had maybe pre-planned already the next week. But then the messages that we received from them, we would say, okay, fine, we'll change it, and all the time change it. Because there's no point sending messages or tasks for children that are not on their level, that if we would hit it on a different level. So it had to be iterative, kind of an innovation project going on all the time. Learning also was based on active learning theories, in a way that, as we know, we learn much better when we are doing something than just like, unfortunately, everybody here is now listening to me, but soon we have the interactive part of it as well, and you get to kind of think for yourself about it. So for example, now when I'm talking, I'm learning the most and not you, because I have to be thinking about my own thought and my own words. And this is why, as a teacher, I actually try to speak as little as possible. But as a lecturer, it's totally different then as well. But active learning was something that we really tried to make them do something and try out things and build things and these kind of things as well. So that it was not only for us, for them to listen to us. Like I know some during the distance education, there was a lot of maybe just like children also just listening to teachers talking. Okay, living conditions I've a little bit talked about already. The weather conditions, sandstorms and so forth, extreme heat, plus 50 degrees or so forth. But also the water had to be carried from far distances. The children could have diarrhea because of the health and hygiene and nutrition wasn't so good. So it was really extreme and very restricted. The safety issues were all the time there. We started the project already thinking about the safety in a way that we made pseudonyms for ourselves. They knew me as Sarah, And then we had I had another teacher partner who was actually still at that time doing her master's thesis, hadn't been teacher before, but she was specializing in special education, and she came helped me and also taught with me. So and she also had a pseudonym, and she has never wanted to come to public with this, which I understand now that she has started her own first year of teaching in Finland. So the extremist ideologies, in a way, we were not, or at least I wasn't really concerned about that we would be kind of attacked or anything like that in Finland. But anyway, we wanted to keep it as safe place as possible. So also the children were able to have pseudonyms as well. And when I have met some of the children, I was also surprised that their name wasn't exactly what I had thought as well. And they were just as well surprised when they heard that I'm also of a different name. But this was mutually thought. The challenge is, like I said a little bit, that as the mobile phones were forbidden, that was a challenge, but also the internet connection was weak. So, for example, if I would be here now teaching everybody on WhatsApp today, here, you, we would be able to do a lot of different things, much, much more than I was able to do with them. Because the internet connection was so weak, we were not able to send them, for example, downloadable materials that you can do on a WhatsApp. Or we were not able to send them any links for internet sources. That was not a possibility. We were not also able to have video calls and these kind of things. So we basically only did it on a text, voice messages that were pre-recorded, and then also emojis, and sometimes also photographs, because that was kind of important as well, to be able to, that I would be able to draw something and take a photograph of that, or that they are able to take photographs of their own notebooks, for example, to the teachers. But also about even the photographs, they said that it will take too long time to download, and also that it was too expensive for them to do that. So there was not really real-time connection in that sense. Only sometimes, occasionally, that we could see that they are there and there would be kind of an instant messaging. Okay, then further. The role of the mothers was really important. Obviously, without the mothers' support and interest for the education, we would not have been able to do this. Because they are the ones who, first of all, enrolled their children to the school. They are the ones who you know, saw our messages first, showed them to their children, and also maybe took pictures, like I said, of their notework for us. The mothers also recorded the voice messages of the children to us so that we would hear how they are speaking or how they are reading, and these kind of things. So and also they were giving us the feedback all the time that how is it going on and how are their children kind of perceiving the task, and is it too difficult and so forth. It was really important to have a very good communication with the mothers. And this is something that some people have always been asking me, that how was I able to communicate on a very mutual level and respectful way to people who might have committed crimes against humanity. But this is, again, we were really thinking about the children and the children's education. So it wasn't my task to kind of, you know, put the women in a court or judge them and think about what they have done, because that was not my job. My job was to teach the children, and to teaching the children, I had a very good communication with their mothers. And I knew that when they are come to Finland, once they are here, the Finnish police and all the authorities are going to be interviewing them, and then if needed, they are put to trial. So that was not my job. So I needed to always remember what is my position, what is my role. And my role was to interact with the women, to build trust with them so that they can trust me and be very open and as a human to human to speak with them. And that kind of takes also understanding in order to do these kind of things with people that you know that have committed horrible crimes. About the students then, because of course we were there for the students. So we had in the beginning we had 3 levels that we created, but then at the end we made 4 levels because we realized that that there is a lot of difference there as well. But like I said, most of the children were born in Syria, and so they had never been to Finland, and they were really learning the Finnish language. So these were from 2 to 5 year old children, and we called them apples. And then the strawberries were 5 to 8 year old, but even there we had a kind of a differentiation inside as well, because not everybody could do exactly the same. And then we had these basic education level students from 9 to 13, actually like 15, but still the 14 to 19 year old ones had their own group, the watermelons, but then still, how would I say it? Some of them, the tasks, when you see this, a lot of people might be thinking like, okay, you know, that these, the level of the tasks are similar to those tasks given to these age children in Finland, for example. This is not the case. So the 2 and a 5 year old would be given such tasks that you would do maybe with a 6-month-old baby who is learning a language in the arms of her mother. Like when I remember when I had my own children, you would go around and say, okay, look, a lamp, you know, a cat, and so forth, because there's an interaction, they are learning the language. So this is the 2 to 5 year old ones. Then from 5 to 8 year old ones are doing the kind of things that they are doing in the kindergarten. And then 9 to 13 year old ones are doing the kind of things that are in Finland, maybe doing in first or second grade. And then the 14 to 19 year old ones are doing stuff like from 3rd, 4th, 5th grade, or maybe 6th grade. But really, like, it was all on a very different level that when you think about it, like when you see the ages. How we started designing it is really so that, of course, we took the Finnish education curriculum from the early childhood education and the comprehensive education and even from high school education. But we really, like I said, realized that we have to go and differentiate it as low as possible. We had Finnish language, mathematics, environmental studies, geography, history, civics, and also for some of them, English as a language. Everything was arranged so that all the messages that we knew that are going to be sent tomorrow were to each and every group for each and every level or each and every individual were pre-planned and made into a very logical order. So it wasn't like, you know, that you would just take a WhatsApp and just text, okay, let's see what I'm doing. It was all pre-planned and logically put into order. And then we always had to always think about as well that what is the learner's environment? What is it that they have? They didn't have much. So, but they would have maybe a lot of different kind of clothing, some cutlery, there's stones and sticks. Actually, there were some stray dogs also that were there that they showed us. Some had puppies and so forth. So we had to think about what is it that they have there that they are able to use in the learning. And also the other thing is, again, the safety issue that we really couldn't give them tasks outside their tent because there's other children from other nationalities and this had to be kept secret so that the others wouldn't see that they are getting this kind of an education and teaching. There had been some women who had been murdered just the same spring before we started because some other ISIS women had thought that they have two Western ideologies and philosophies. So our teaching to the children could have been also looked at as too Western, as a propaganda, and that's why it had to be kept very secret as well, so that the children would not be able to do things outside the tent. So that if we asked them to go and collect stones or sticks, also that had to be kept kind of secrecy, that why are they doing that and what are they doing it with? Like I said, everything was differentiated to suit the individual needs as well. And then we had the themes for every kind of maybe weeks. There would be more about food, or other time it would be more about everyday life. Or once we knew that they are starting to come to Finland, we started telling them about what is the everyday life in, for example, in daycare. What are the children, what they do in Finland, and what is the school kind of timetable and so forth, so that to orient themselves towards Finland. Okay, like I said, the routines and was very important. So every morning, like I said, we started at 9 o'clock so that they knew that this is the time when the messages will come. And always the same message, kind of the same structure in the message, that it was like, hello, regards and weather report from Finland. So kind of chit and chat as well at the same time. And then the goals and the task, what is for the day. And basically only one subject per day, because it couldn't be more than that. It's too much asked. Some of the older children were also working at the same time. There's, like I said, there's an ecosystem, and the women also would be working as well. So that they would be able to do the tasks maybe in the, if they are able to do it in the morning or then later in the evening. So maybe like Finnish on Monday, mathematics on Tuesday, Wednesday again Finnish language, then Thursday again mathematics, and then Friday maybe science, the kind of environmental studies. But then in the afternoon, we would send another messages at 1 to 2 p.m., which would be more like poems or stories or pictures or games that they would maybe able to play with them as well, and these kind of things. In between, of course, there was also instant different kind of messages as well. Some spontaneous messages. But this is like an example. This is now in Finnish. There was some messages like this also in English, but now the examples are all in Finnish. Okay, so today is the day, and what is the weather like? And then today what we're going to be learning is the Finnish language about emotions, or letter N, or synonyms. The amount of messages that we sent is just enormous. I think I have, it says here, hundreds of Word documents, but it's like thousands of pages of Word documents. Per day, there would be maybe 40 to 70 pieces of messages per group. There was the different groups I earlier showed you here from A to G. And then afternoon messages were a little bit less, from 5 to 6 pieces per group. And then from their side to us, there would be maybe 0 messages per day or 20 messages per day. We never knew what is coming from their side, but we had to always keep it up. And then if the messages came from their side, then of course we would also reply to them and comment them and so forth. And some messages also then in the evenings and weekends, maybe 5 to 20 per group. So it was like 24/7. Some of them would be messages coming at 11 p.m. or Sunday morning, or you know, we never knew when the messages are coming to us. Here's a little bit examples of the Finnish language. There is, for example, practicing letter A. And you can see that there's also these voice messages. So that because the mothers were not speaking necessarily Finnish to them, we would need to give them examples of how does it sound like in Finnish. So Aino, who is the other teacher, would be sending, for example, their apina, and then I would at the same time, because we were in different places, we never saw face to face. We never met with her during the project, only after, when once we had done it. So we never saw each other, but we were also chatting, of course. But she would be sending apina, for example, and then I would be pressing and saying apina, apina, maybe a few times. And then she would put pupu, and then I would say pupu, pupu, and so forth. Or then just the letters, for example, na, 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 nau, i, in, ni, niu, and so forth. Then the older ones would be learning other kind of things as well. Of course, in Finnish language, this ang, gengat, genga, these kind of things had to be taught. Some of them were also reading already. One six-year-old girl learned how to read during this project as well. Not only words, but also whole stories, which I think was a kind of a heureka moment when we realized that she has learned to read. But this particular boy wasn't really interested in a lot of the things that we sent to him. And then we asked, like, okay, what are you interested in? Is there anything that you are interested in? And he said he's interested in big animals. So I said, okay, fine, let's start, you know, giving you a lot of different big animal messages and texts. So we sent them about here are the giraffes, but also about, you know, elephants or tigers or the moose and so forth. So then he started being motivated to, and the reading came much better as well. The little ones, like I said, who were just learning about the words in Finnish, we also sent a lot of different kind of emojis. So here, for example, just clothing emojis, and then they would have to say, what is it? And also they had been learning maybe about the color. What is the color? So this is red, this is blue, this is white, and so forth as well. Mathematics. Some of them would maybe know how to say in Finnish, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, the numbers, but they had no sense of what it means. They had no sense that number 5 is bigger than 4 and is smaller than 6. So these kind of things had to be taught to them, where is the number and so forth. So this is something that we had to do a lot and kind of continuously as well. The older ones, yes, they were able to maybe do kind of additions and subtractions, but then the multiplication was already a little bit difficult, and especially division, and division had to be then taught as well. But then we, for the very older ones, we were also teaching percentages and decimals and these kind of things as well. Geography, civics, environmental studies. We were also trying to say, you know, tell them what is going on around the world at that time. At that time, it was the presidential elections in USA. So we told them also that, you know, this kind of election is going on, that there is two candidates and who they are and how the presidential elections are done in USA. This was for the older students who were from 14 to 19 year old. Actually, one thing that I need to also tell you that some of these older students were mothers themselves, that they had had also. So some of them had the younger ones that we were teaching, and then they were also mothers themselves as well, forced to marry at a very young age. So English as well, both stories and listening, and as well as and then games and stories. There was a book, for example, that I read to them out loud, chapter by chapter every week. Came one chapter that I read to them every Friday, and then the next Friday, and again the next chapter, and so forth. And they love to hear the stories. And you can imagine if they have no TV, no internet, no nothing, basically, no books, that this was kind of something that they loved. And every day we sent them at least a small poem or something that they could both read as well as listen. So the objectives, like I told you already a little bit before, were really the language awareness, the recognition and the production of the letters and sounds and syllables, and getting acquainted with kind of different kind of texts and so forth. We also told them sometimes, for the older ones, can you write to us a little bit about what you did, for example, during the weekend? And they would write to us about how they, some of them had kites, that they had built up kites and were flying the kites or playing soccer or these kind of things. Listening comprehension was really there all the time. And then the mathematical numeracy, understanding the concepts and then making classifications and comparing, for example, measuring skills also. And measuring, because they didn't have any how to measure, we taught them how to measure with your fingers, with your body parts, with your, you know, steps and then measure different kind of things as well, or taking the cutlery, how to measure how many cups and these kind of things. So measuring skills also were done with the things that they had present over there that they were able to use. They also had to make a lot of observations and inquiry into their own environment. For example, I think he was like about measuring as well, but here this is make observations around or inside your tent as well, that what are things that are living and non-living, for example, entities. And then this was all to also to strengthen their own self-appreciation and also to develop their learning strategies and lifelong learning kind of skills and curiosity towards the surrounding environment. Transversal competences, of course, like in Finland, we have this. So we were talking a lot about feelings and emotions. You can imagine what kind of place it is that a lot of children have a lot of worries. They had no idea what had happened to their fathers, for example. Maybe they were already dead, and also they had no kind of thought about the future. And the older they were, the more problematic this was as well. Agency. We tried to also, of course, like I said about this active learning, to promote this kind of learner's own agency. And we were always providing them a lot of positive feedback that, well done, you have now understood this and keep on going, and giving them that kind of sort of sense of ability and self-esteem as well. And hopefully we were also providing them a little bit hope that what is out there and possibly that they are able to come back from there. And like I said, there's still a few children where over there that Finland has not been able to repatriate. Positivity, and some of the women and the children, by the way, the first ones were the ones who escaped via Turkey and came by escaping. But then after that, it was the Ministry of Finland who were able to repatriate them. So the evaluation was about positivity, collaboration with the mothers. It was continuous every day, every Friday. We had a certain also kind of a questions that we provided them, and we really needed to measure their developmental stage, because there was no point giving something that was too difficult for them, and so it had to be according to their own possibility. And this is something that that kind of became our main thing, that to be courageous enough to go lower enough on the tasks. That not to think like, you know, this is something that, why should we give this so silly task? But we really needed to be brave enough, because that is where then they felt that, okay, I'm able to do and I'm able to carry on and learn. And that's when learning then also happened and the motivation was there. So here is then some maybe feedback and questions and also that, well, you know, well done and so forth. So we were using a lot of emojis, collect the feedback from the students and from the mothers. Okay, I have been already talking about this differentiation and boldly enough, but this is also because of the traumas how the traumas kind of function and how it affects our learning capacities, and if there are feelings of insecurity and fears and traumas as well, then it causes so much stress and therefore kind of people are not capable of taking in a lot of new things, and then therefore it has to be very, like I said, only one subject per day, little things per day, and then at the right level as well. This is something that we know now of these children who have come to Finland, that especially the older ones who have come back to Finland, because they were at 9 years old or 10 years old or, you know, 12 years old when they left Finland, and now they are like, you know, 15, 17, 16, 19, or 20, or whatever, is that they have come back to that place where they were in a secure place, maybe understanding also that their friends have carried on and they have been in over there. This is the time when they now have a lot of this post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms and really are in a lot of need for psychological support. And because that is when usually this trauma really kicks in, is that when you are in a safe place, then all the backlashes and everything comes back again. And that is why the children, especially now, they need a lot of support. We've been also asked a lot about Islam, that how kind of Islam affected our teaching. And it really didn't a lot. Like I said, we were talking as human to human level for with these mothers. There was only Ramadan that a little bit interrupted the teaching in a way that they wanted to celebrate it and have a break. And we said, fine, you can do it. They wanted to bake something. There was another celebration later on. And only one story was from one mother and from one child. She said that this is not a good story. I cannot share this story with my child, and she is not allowed to read this. And why was it? It's because there was magic in it. And magic is something that in Islam is not kind of looked at as possible. So we just said, fine, no worries. We'll find you another story and to read. So that was basically the only time when we realized that we had given a wrong task for the child. Otherwise, all the tasks were fine. Okay, the importance of education in hardship locations, and I'm wrapping up now so that we can continue with other things. But like Heidi started also, that we are now living in a world where there's more and more of these emergencies, and why education is really important for children is like we started, is the routine and the kind of meaningful activities, and it's also to build or recover the basic skills as well. It depends again for how long have the children been without education, that how much is there to catch up. Or then to keep it going, so that the basic skills are not forgotten, like what happened, for example, with these children. It's also to provide them maybe some kind of hope and joy of learning, but also through education we can provide actual information about the world and what is happening. There's a lot of disinformation and misinformation going around, and education with responsible teachers can also provide the children actual proper information about current world affairs. It's also kind of a sense of inclusion, because in hardship locations you feel very alone and very neglected and kind of apart from everybody else. And education, even though this is kind of a mobile education and from a distance done, that we never saw them except once back in Finland, but it's a sense of inclusion, that there's somebody out there who listens to me, who asks me how am I doing, and listens to the worries and provides kind of joy as well and gives feedback. So there is a sense of that I'm included, that I'm worth something, and this is something what happened as well with these children. If there is an integration into a new country or repatriation, like in our case, also education became a vehicle for this as well. And of course, education is a part of lifelong learning skills. What was our success? Like what I have said already before is that the basic academic skills were developed. They learned how to read or write, or it became more fluent. And then also numeracy and these kind of things. And really what we also wanted to do is to provide them lifelong learning skills and hope and self-confidence, and possibly also to reduce the risk of exclusion and de-radicalization as well, kind of in a way that they don't get also radicalized, because these environments, like I started with, are very possible places where extremism can flourish as well. Okay, here you can read them yourself. These are from the mothers. Okay, so I think I've already been talking about this as well, that education is a tool to combat the radicalization, and this is something that we really need to remember with education in emergencies and during emergencies, that how education can decrease potential for radicalization. And dialogue, like what I was doing with the mothers, is really the one way of doing it. Altogether, advantages of mobile education is that it's very fastly organized, like we did it very quickly. Most of the people around the world have mobile phones, even in most remote areas and very low economic countries as well. It's very quick, instant. It's very individual because it's on your hand. People feel it like it's personally to me, the messages that when they come. It's also inexpensive. Like I said, that you can do it on a very minimal level, that if you don't take all the necessary downloadable material, these kind of things, excess materials that are then more expensive to do, so that you can do it also offline in a way, that when the messages are gone, then they are able to, you can read them, go through them, even though that you are offline. It's also very informal. Like I said, it was like 24/7 as well. And a lot of the children learned how to use it. Even the little ones sometimes were playing with the mobile phones and sent us messages, and the mothers were like, oh, sorry. But I said, well, fine, it's okay. At least I can see that they're, you know, writing or speaking in Finnish to me. So I'm happy. So no worries. Yeah, it's very, very personal, and therefore it's very motivating and as well, and can be individualized.